I want to make sure that you're all in the right place. I'm very impressed by this turnout, but because of my name, I frequently have an identity crisis. I was recently doing a television program in Philadelphia. I have been literally on tour ever since I testified to Senator Sam Ervin's subcommittee about 3 weeks ago. This was one of these late-night news programs, and I think the television station was more or less operated out of a shoebox. It was really a low-budget operation. And about the middle of the interview, my eye happened to catch the monitor, and there I saw myself, and the super said, "Arthur Miller, playwright and author." At that point, I decided to question what I was doing with my life. As I'm sure you all know, in recent years, there has been a growing concern over the effects certain data gathering activities and applications of information technology may have on individual privacy. Many people, including myself, have voiced the fear that the computer, with its supposed insatiable appetite for information, its image of infallibility, its inability to forget anything that has been put into it, may become the heart of a surveillance system that will turn our society into a transparent world in which our home, our lives, and our associations are bared to the most casual observer. A brief recital of some of the blessings and the blasphemies of the new technology will pose the computer privacy dilemma very sharply. In various medical centers throughout the country, doctors are using computers to monitor physiological changes in the bodies of heart patients. The hope, of course, is to develop an early warning system to isolate those changes in the physiological or chemical structure of the blood that appear prior to the heart attack. As things now stand, many patients are moribund for all practical purposes when the attack actually strikes. Other plans for the computer include the development of the birth number, the universal number, to identify people for tax, banking, education, social security, and draft purposes. This would be done, of course, in conjunction with heightened and accelerated computerization of individualized records. The goal here is to eliminate much of the existing multiplicity in record keeping that currently characterizes our information gathering agencies, and at the same time expedite the business of society, perhaps through such means as developing a checkless, cashless society, and developing the massive informational databases so badly needed by our society for rational resource allocation and servicing of our underprivileged population. Similarly, this birth number could prove to be a valuable aid in protecting the individual. Suppose a citizen falls ill while in Europe and must go to a doctor that has no knowledge of his prior medical history. With the birth number, computer technology, satellite transmission, it might be possible for the French doctor immediately to gain access to the individual's medical record sitting in New York or Illinois and treat him much more rapidly than otherwise might be possible. But let's glance for a minute at the opposite side of the ledger. It has been claimed that the same electronic sensors that can warn us of an impending heart attack can be used with its sophistication to locate us, track our movements, measure our emotions, and in time, test our thoughts. Experiments are already underway in the field of telemetering, and I have heard supposedly reputable criminologists suggest that all people in prisons be subjected to sensor implantation before their release so that they can be monitored by law enforcement agencies following their release. I suppose the theory is if the computer at the police station goes beep, beep too rapidly, it indicates a high aggression level on the part of the former prisoner and the propensity to perform some antisocial act. How they're going to distinguish between the rapid beeping when he's contemplating a burglary or attending a Chicago a bear game. I'm not quite sure, but they say they can do it. Thus it is that this notion of the identification number has been called a leash around our necks that might over time make us the object of constant surveillance and the victim of the fabled womb-to-tomb dossier. Thus it is that close scrutiny and evaluation of the implications of data technology on individual privacy is especially appropriate at this time. We find a clarion in almost all quadrants of our society for increased utilization of the computer and the increased individualization of computerized records. We saw the fight over the National Data Center in 1967. We discover that millions of individuals are subjects of computerized credit bureau reports. A close examination of President Nixon's welfare package, the Family Assistance Act, and the Manpower Training Act show provisions for the creation of large welfare recipient data banks and the sharing of information between federal and state and local welfare agencies. Not a word, however, about the privacy implications or file confidentiality. No matter where one looks these days, he finds a hypnotic attraction to digital record keeping, an attraction that, of course, the universities are not immune from. I'm not sure whether here at Illinois you have computerized student ID numbers or not, but they are, of course, the first step in the computerization of faculty and student records. Indeed, they tell the story of the trend toward computer-based research, which is now so clear in the social sciences, particularly in political science, but now affecting English. It's now very fashionable to take Edward Albee and computerize Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and then ask the computer such significant questions as how many times did Albee use a certain four-letter antisocial word. But in any event, the story goes that there's this middle-aged English professor who refused to use the computer. All his colleagues are doing the new type of research. So to convince this older man, who may have been all of 40 or so, his colleagues computerized his life. His entire life history, and they put it into the computer, and they said, come on, Joe, we'll show you how good this computer is in terms of answering your questions and doing research for you. Just sit down and ask the computer anything about yourself. Well, the gentleman sat down. He said, what is my name? Computer word and spit back, your name is John Q. Smith. How many children do I have? And again, the computer went through its electronic gyrations and said, you have 3 children, ages 22, 15, and 11. The old man was quite impressed. He thought for a minute, and he typed in, what is my father doing? A computer, again, word and spit back, your father is fishing off the coast of Florida. The old man smiled. He says, I have now beaten the machine. And with a frenzied piece of typing, he put in, you stupid electronic machine, my father died 5 years ago. The machine paused. Then it started, gyrated and spit back, the man your mother married died 5 years ago. I have sadly reached the conclusion that today Americans are scrutinized, watched, counted, recorded, and questioned by more governmental agencies, social scientists, and law enforcement officials than at any time in our history. Whether we know it or not, each time we file a tax return, apply for life insurance or a credit card, seek a governmental benefit, or interview for a job, a dossier is opened on us and an informational profile is sketched. It has now reached the point that whenever we travel on a commercial airline, reserve a room at one of the national hotel chains, or rent a car, we are likely to be leaving distinctive electronic tracks in the memory of a computer. tracks that can tell a great deal about us and our activities, habits, and association if monitored. And the evidence is that they are being monitored. The airline reservation system is periodically monitored by the FBI for travel patterns among the alleged mafia capo. So whenever you travel on a plane or use your Diners Club or American Express card, look around the room and make sure there's no mafia man with you, because you will be associated with him, at least in the FBI's National Crime Information Center. Rarely does a day go by without the existence of some new individual data bank being disclosed. In recent months, Senator Sam Ervin's Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights has told us about the Department of Housing and Urban Development's Adverse Information File, the National Science Foundation's data bank on scientists, those who are with the administration, those who are against it, the Customs Bureau's computerized data bank on what are called suspects, the Civil Service Commission's investigative and security files, the Justice Department's intelligence bank run by its civil disturbance group. The Department of State has a passport lookout service with 250,000 names on it to make sure that we watch those who travel abroad and might sully our otherwise unblemished foreign policy. The National Driver Register Service has 2.6 million names and driver records on it, and the Secret Service has dossiers on what it calls undesirables, activists, and malcontents, like me. Now, by and large, these data-gathering activities are well-intended. I am not one who subscribes to the great conspiratorial theory of life. For example, the law enforcement field, file building is necessary to combat organized crime and restore law and order. The National Crime Information Center, for example, gives a state highway patrolman an instant readout on a suspicious car, who its driver is likely to be, whether the car is stolen, and whether the driver is likely to be a fugitive from justice, all of which, it seems to me, are vitally essential lest he run an undue risk of having his head shot off when he approaches the vehicle. In a similar vein, the FBI and the Army can and have tried to justify their intelligence activities in terms of combating subversion or quelling campus disruptions in our urban centers. But I submit there is an important and unfortunately largely ignored negative side to these mushrooming data banks, particularly those data banks that bear the imprimatur of the federal or state governments. Consider the activities of the United States Army. About 1 year ago, it was revealed that since 1966, the Army intelligence has systematically been keeping watch on the lawful, and I underscore the word lawful, political activity of a number of groups, and have been preparing individualized dossiers on them and what are called incident reports. It must be emphasized that this monitoring not only has covered what are euphemistically called society's crazies, but has extended to such nonviolent organizations as the NAACP, the ACLU, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Women's Strike for Peace, and allegedly to newsmen, congressmen, senators, and Judge Kerner of the Seventh Circuit. Indeed, the Defense Department, in appearing before Senator Sam Ervin's subcommittee 2 weeks ago, admitted there is a master index on 25 million Americans. Surely there are not 25 million Americans who are bomb throwers or anything near to it. The military itself now has close to 8 million dossiers, and this has been accumulated in the short period of 5 years. In a remarkable display of honesty, the Defense Department admitted it overreacted. Although there is considerable justification for certain types of information collection that are directly relevant to the Army's duties, including the Army's duties in times of civil or internal disorder. The development of dossiers on people pursuing lawful, social, and political activities bears little relationship to those duties, especially when many of those who are under scrutiny are extremely unlikely to engage in riotous conduct, and especially when the selection of suspects seems to be governed by an incredibly simplistic, these are the good guys and those are the bad guys. Not only is the Army's file building difficult to justify, but it appears to have been undertaken without sufficient consideration of the fact that the creation and the potential exposure of these dossiers, dossiers on people who are politically active, could deter them from exercising their rights of speech, assembly, petition of the government, and dissent. If a citizen's conduct and associations are put on file and perhaps used or at least potentially available for use to harass or injure him, he may become more concerned about the possible content of his file and less willing to stick his neck out in the pursuit of his constitutionally guaranteed rights. The effect may be, to paraphrase a thought expressed by Mr. Justice Brennan in Lopez versus United States, to encourage Americans to keep their mouth shut on all occasions. If we really take our constitutional guarantees seriously, we simply cannot afford to stand idly by and allow them to be debilitated by this type of coercive data collection. Because of the potential development of a record prison mentality, a mentality that seems to me strikingly similar or analogous to Orwell's concept of Big Brother on a TV screen, who in his own way is monitoring the activities of the citizenry, we should not be surprised if some have already suggested that we are seeing the seeds of the much dreaded police state or a return to McCarthyism. Now, to prevent any doubt on the point, I personally do not oppose information systems or computerization of data. I am not a 20th century Luddite with an axe out to smash the machines. It strikes me as foolish to try to prevent the use of a modern technology to carry out important governmental and non-governmental operations simply because it might be abused. This is especially true in a complex, urbanized society such as ours, which, as I said earlier, really is in desperate need for sound data for national planning. In addition, it is foolish to think in terms of turning the hands on the clock back. The answer to slaughter on the highway or the ecological crisis, to draw two analogies, is not necessarily to ban the automobile, the airplane, or the factory. What is necessary and what may be the solution is to develop a framework for the protection of the public and to superimpose that framework on the scientific and technical innovations of the day. The hope, of course, would be to minimize the misuse of an otherwise socially desirable technology. This exercise in striking a balance between democracy and technology has been a frequent and often manageable chore in the past, and we should not shirk our responsibilities to undertake it at this time. Let me turn now to the particular tensions between contemporary data activities and privacy. Informational privacy has been relatively easy to protect in the past for a number of reasons. In the first place, large quantities of information simply have not been collected about individuals until very recently. We had low literacy rate in the United States until this century. We had very little record keeping. We had very little governmental involvement in the private sector, and files of any sophisticated character simply were virtually non-existent. In short, informational privacy was not really much of a problem at all. In addition, until recently, the available information has been decentralized. Pockets of data at your school, at your doctor, at your lawyer, at the police station, where you work. But basically decentralized and very difficult in terms of time and expense to assemble and collate. In addition, access to the data, even for someone who is willing to undertake the job of ferreting it out from its decentralized stores, was very difficult to achieve. To me, it's quite perverse that one of the great bastions of individual informational privacy has been that most document custodians never seem to grow out of their anal retentive period. Furthermore, people in a highly mobile society are difficult to keep track of. One of the great joys of an open frontier is that you can move away from your past. And one finds in the 19th century, certainly that was the motivation for many people going west. Finally, until recently, there has not been something called information science. People have simply not developed the sophistication needed to infer second and third level data out of the available superficial primary level data. Unfortunately, however, these protections are all part of a bygone age and are completely alien in a technologically based society. The testimony elicited before several subcommittees of the United States Congress has presented a simply astounding and disheartening panorama of the way in which the intruders in our society, often aided by the fruits of modern science, have destroyed many of these traditional bastions of privacy. We have seen revelations concerning the widespread use of spike and parabolic microphones, a variety of gadgets for electronic eavesdropping, the development of cameras equipped with optical devices that enable photographs to be taken under adverse weather conditions and at a great distance. They tell me now that one of the satellites has the technological capacity of spotting a marijuana patch from 110 miles up. Beware. Moving from physical privacy to informational privacy, we now find that this ever-increasing resort to the computer, laser technology for the implantation and storage of digital data, and micro-miniaturization techniques all are beginning to erode our informational privacy. We live, and we should face up to the fact that we live in an information-based society. Information is both power, and information is an economic commodity in our age. Ever since the government entered the taxation and social welfare spheres, greater quantities of information have been sought from citizens and recorded. Moreover, in recent years, access to governmental largesse has increasingly depended upon a willingness to divulge private information. Just as a footnote, the recent Supreme Court case in the James case, giving access to the home of welfare recipients, I think is an illustration of that. In addition, recording processes have become cheaper and more efficient and have facilitated the gathering, storage, and manipulation of the increasing amounts of data collected from citizens. What we see is a sort of a Parkinson's law. As the technology for information handling grows and gives us greater capacity to handle information, we tend to be motivated to go out and collect more data to fill that capacity. Take a look at a 1970 tax form and compare it with a tax form from the 50s, and you will be very, very greatly surprised at the number and sensitivity of questions that have been added to the forms in these past 15 years. The reason for that is very simple. Electronic data processing enables the government to handle that kind of data, which it hitherto was incapable of doing. Thus, I think it is reasonable to assume, and I think recent events bear this out, that one consequence of the advent of data centers and increased computer capacity is that many governmental and private information gathering agencies are going to increase their questioning and go into hitherto private or sensitive areas, perhaps to include such subjects as associations with other people, location and activity at different points of time and space, medical history, and our attitudes toward various institutions and persons. There are additional risks other than sheer quantity of information extracted from us. As information accumulates, the contents of an individual's computerized dossier tend to appear more and more impressive to the user of that dossier. This despite the softness of the data. There is this monstrous myth of computer infallibility and the pressures of modern society. When coupled, it seems to me, they are going to encourage people increasingly to make decisions about us on the basis of the file. We are beginning to see more and more of this in terms of credit-granting agencies, educational institutions, and private employers. For this reason, many people have come to feel that their success or failure in life ultimately may turn on what other people put into their file and some unknown programmer's ability or inability to evaluate, process, and interrelate that information. In addition, a computerized file, at least to date, has had a certain indelible quality. Adversities do not seem to be overcome with time, and we have not yet developed the concept of the electronic eraser and developed people with compassionate enough souls to be willing to use it. The centralization of information from widely divergent sources also creates serious problems of information accuracy. And I'm not now talking about literal accuracy, how much you earn, whether you have or do not have a degree, although one might suppose that with increased data collection about each individual, you are simply increasing the risk of error. But what I am really talking about is contextual accuracy. Information can be entirely accurate, self-explanatory, and sufficient in one environment, the environment in which it is collected, and be wholly incomplete, misleading, and damaging in another. A very rough example is the tremendous divergence of rating scales. Great universities rate their students in terms of great student bodies. So fantastic may mean marginally competent. On the other hand, I've got that backwards. Marginally competent in a great university may mean an individual of superior intellect. On the other hand, some societal institutions have quite the reverse in terms of their evaluative scheme. The Army, for example, in which a rating of superhuman may mean one cut above mongoloid. No, I think in a very sad sense, there is an illustration of that in the Kelly trial. I don't know how many of you have read the reports of his efficiency ratings as contrasted with his background. And I think that may be an instance in which the Army got trapped into believing their own efficiency reports. Perhaps I can present the problem of contextual accuracy in terms of what I believe is one of the most dangerous forms of information circulating in our society, the unexplained and incomplete arrest record. Is it likely that a citizen whose file contains the entry arrested, June 1, 1942, convicted, felony, January 5, 1943, sentenced, 3 years, Leavenworth, will be given governmental employment or be accorded the other amenities of an organized society? Yet our subject may simply have been a conscientious objector during the Second World War. Indeed, the file I just read to you is of a conscientious objector, and that's how his entry appears on the FBI rap sheet that circulates about him. How about this one? Arrested, criminal trespass, convicted, sentenced, 6 months. Without more, how will the file user know that our computerized man was simply demonstrating for equal opportunity in the North or desegregated education in the South, and was convicted under a state criminal trespass statute long since declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court as an illegal restraint on the First Amendment? Yet one finds that this type of data is indeed circulating. The best estimates are that fully one-third of the FBI rap sheet, fully one-third, in other words, of the arrest records circulating in the country, are either not fully explained or are incomplete in the sense that they do not show disposition. Take what is a common occurrence, a police sweep in a black ghetto, or a law enforcement sweep on a campus. 100 picked up and arrested. Of the 100, the 40 perhaps may be immediately released. 20 more may be held but not prosecuted. 20 more may be prosecuted but acquitted. Of the 20 who are prosecuted and convicted, 10 may have their convictions reversed on appeal. Fully 90 of the 100 may have, under our system of justice, not been guilty of a crime. Yet all 100 have arrest records, and the chances are that at least 30 of the 90 who were never convicted will not have the fact of no conviction or no prosecution indicated on the arrest record. And I'm not talking now of this type of data circulating within law enforcement agencies to the exclusion of other information gathering agencies. The fact is that we have in our society a subterranean network of information interchange. You find that most corporate security men, most bank security men, most insurance investigators are former law enforcement or military intelligent people. The result is that on a professional tit-for-tat type basis, great quantities of personal information is circulating outside the environment it originally was collected in. And I'm not talking now about maliciousness. I am simply talking of the insensitivity or the unawareness or the internal pressures of people who are in like occupations. Thus, it should not be surprising that 2 weeks ago in the state of New York, four of the nation's largest credit or consumer reporting agencies were convicted of bribing New York State policemen for releasing illegally under New York State law arrest records. What then is the solution? Well, one would hope that as an initial matter, good judgment, self-restraint on the part of the information gathering and computer fraternities would suffice. After all we theoretically need is a realization on the part of all who handle individualized data, whether that data be in the context of financial profiles in a credit bureau, student records in a university record system, medical files in a hospital, welfare lists in a governmental agency, or personnel files in a large corporation. All of these people have an obligation to guard the privacy of the human beings whose lives are reflected in the computerized files they handle. And in many senses, self-regulation does look promising. In the 4 years since I have been involved in this field, there has been a remarkable growth in awareness of the problem on the part of many private and governmental agencies. I've been involved in recent weeks in helping to draft internal guidelines for privacy protection at the National Science Foundation, at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, at the Office of Science and Technology. So there is a growing awareness. But in the long run, it may simply be unrealistic to rely on the good faith and self-restraint on the part of the very people whose lives depend on gathering, processing, and selling that type of data. If self-restraint fails, then obviously we must look to the legal profession, and we must become more active. Personally, I am not very sanguine about the development of judicial doctrine in this area. As I argue at length in my book, I do not believe that the solution of achieving a balance between society's legitimate information needs and the protection of the individual in his privacy can realistically be achieved through the courts. In the first place, the common law tort of privacy has always been preoccupied with the mass media. You find almost no decisions of a common law character really dealing with problems of the kind we are talking about this morning. Secondly, recent cases in the field of file expungement have not been too promising. We've had cases in New Jersey, in Washington, and in the federal court in Chicago in terms of trying to enjoin governmental data collection and achieve the expungement of files maintained in one case by the FBI. The courts have been quite timid. They have been unable to find the appropriate doctrinal peg, and they have been far too willing to rely on the good faith of the data collecting agencies. Third, I fear that the Supreme Court's decisions in cases like Time, Inc. versus Hill have seriously castrated the ability of the tort of privacy to grow. And I fear that cases like Hill will act as a great millstone around the court's neck in developing judicial protection for files and file security. On the other hand, the judicial vineyard is not entirely blighted. I think one could piece together a good right of informational privacy from a spectrum of cases, starting with, let's say, NAACP versus Alabama, which I think recognizes the right of associational privacy, moving on to Smith and Schneider, in which the Supreme Court seemed willing to protect freedom of belief and thought against governmental intrusion, the Griswold case and the recent obscenity in the home decision, which seems to be pointing to zones of privacy, to use that cliche, although, again, the recent Wyman case may be cutting back on that. And finally, the recent decision by the Supreme Court in the Constantinow case, the town drunk case, which seems to indicate that the Supreme Court believes that a person has a right of due process associated with the circulation of information about him. But unfortunately, all of these cases simply involve the outer boundary of state or federal action. They are simply reflective of what the Supreme Court thinks are the constitutional limits on state activity with regard to individual privacy. They do not represent any attempt to achieve the balance between data collection and individual privacy that I think is so badly needed. That, in my view, must come from the Congress. Legislation can take a number of forms. To me, the only completely effective legislative guardian of individual privacy is the imposition of strict controls over the information that governmental and non-governmental agencies can collect and input into a data system. No procedural or technical safeguard is immune from human abuse or mechanical malfunction. In other words, there has never been a lock invented that didn't have a key. Certain types of information simply should not be collected and recorded. Even though we hear squeals of administrative feasibility and desirability, it has long been technically feasible and from some perspectives desirable to require citizens to carry and display passports when moving through the country or be subjected to universal fingerprinting. But at least to date, this nation has not pursued that policy because, I assume, these encroachments are viewed to be inconsistent with the philosophical fiber of our nation. Thus, it seems to me, in certain areas of sensitive personal information, there must be the most overpowering demonstration on the part of the data collector that the preservation of that data is essential. Thus, highly sensitive personal information, perhaps medical and psychiatric data, that is not needed for treatment of the individual, simply should not be put into computerized form and made the subject of remote access or online systems. There have been at least two legislative proposals seeking to limit federal data collection by requiring direct and specific congressional authorization for the data collection before the agency undertakes it. This is the type of legislation or potentially administrative regulation that I think we are probably going to be moving toward. Another type of legislative or administrative regulation that is essential is a set of safeguards and rules designed to limit access to data. We may be reaching the point in which we will have something akin to highway safety legislation in terms of the manufacturing process for computer hardware and the systems development of the match of hardware and software. Any system dealing with personal information must be designed to limit the exposure of its files to limited classes of authorized people who have a demonstrated and clear need to know particular files. In addition, everyone making an inquiry into an individual file must be required to identify himself. This seems to me imperative so that we can develop a way of monitoring the utilization of files so as to identify people who might be misusing them. In addition, we must recognize that the newer systems operate from geographically separated points, and that data travels via satellite, microwave relay, cable TV, or the telephone. And all of these data streams can be tapped by the same technology that now is used in the wiretapping field. Thus, it may be that the regulation in terms of system control and system development must require the use of cryptography or scramblers to protect data streams. In addition, I think it is absolutely imperative that legislation recognize the individual's right of access to his own files. We have already achieved this in the credit bureau field. Under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which becomes effective throughout the land next month, each of us has a statutory right to go to a credit bureau and ask that its contents be revealed to us, and that any errors in it we can establish be corrected. This principle must be extended beyond the credit reporting field and include all or nearly all of the types of files maintained by other governmental and private institutions. Now, this suggestion obviously may be expensive, especially if it's reinforced by an automatic noticing procedure which requires the agency or private organization to notify an individual whenever a file is opened on him and periodically give him a printed out list of all those who have made inquiries of his file. Nonetheless, it seems to me that the right of an individual to be protected against the content of the files and the dissemination of the files is so important that we simply must pay some economic price for it. Finally, we are going to need legislation that will eliminate the petrification of data. We must develop guidelines under which data that is shown to be inaccurate or archaic or of little probative value is destroyed, deleted, reclassified, or at a very minimum, its age brought to the attention of any user of that file. In the long range, I perceive, and I think this is where Senator Ervin ultimately is going, an information agency. You might call it an information ombudsman, whose function it is to monitor periodically the data collecting activities of the federal government and the private sector. If you're going to ask the question, who's going to watch them? That, of course, is the classic problem of who watches the watchers that we find in criminal law today. But the concept of an auditor is certainly well known throughout industry, and indeed probably the best and most effective auditor that exists is the Government Accounting Office, which currently audits the Congress. When the dust ultimately settles and the legislative battles have been fought, I obviously hope that we have struck the necessary balance. And I think we must face the fact that this balance can be achieved only by give on both sides. There's no doubt that we can coerce and wheedle and cajole an individual into giving up his informational profile, but what price must we be called upon to pay for it? Alienation of large groups in society, who, by the way, generally bear the brunt of the information collecting activities, try to convince people in some of our urban ghettos that the census isn't a way of establishing a national index on black people for incarceration in times of national crisis. Tell them to forget what we did to the Japanese population in 1942 and 3. Distrust of the government, deceptive responses. There are lots of people I meet nowadays who simply put in incorrect data when they are asked for information by governmental agencies. And that is so terribly, terribly sad, because this is the very data that we're supposedly relying on for rational planning. By the way, I know several people who have taken out multiple Social Security numbers so that they can lead double lives. The lost sight of certain values. I think we have, in recent years, given up the utilization of the census or the expectation of the census as being an absolutely refined indicator of population for purposes of apportionment of the Congress, which, after all, is its only constitutionally expressed purpose. In 1960, for example, despite the use of what then were extraordinarily refined techniques, the census missed 5.6 million Americans. It's estimated that the Americans missed resided largely in the urban centers, and it's been estimated that the cities are underrepresented in Congress by between 9 and 12 congressmen, and that the black community is underrepresented to the tune of 3 to 5 congressmen because of the skew in the data. Why the skew? In part because there is significant mistrust of the census in the urban areas. On the other hand, there is no value in our society that really is absolute, and it may become necessary for us to yield a bit of our privacy. Now, if the foregoing seems somewhat alarmist or polemical in tone, I don't apologize. I simply feel that it is necessary to counteract a syndrome so appropriately referred to by the poet E.E. Cummings when he wrote, "Progress is a comfortable disease." And to overcome the all too often complacent attitude of citizens toward the management of our affairs by frequently astigmatic people in both government and the private sectors. The very real benefits conferred by computer technology may be opiating our awareness of the price that is being extracted from us in terms of personal freedom. Thus, it seems to me desirable to sound the klaxon, to arouse a greater awareness of the possibility that the computer is precipitating a realignment in the patterns of societal power and becoming an all too strong tool of decision makers. As society becomes more and more information oriented, the central issue that emerges seems to me to be how to contain the excesses of that technology and channel its benefits for the betterment of all. If the concept of personal privacy is fundamental to our tradition of individual autonomy, and if its preservation seems desirable, then I personally feel that the expenditure of some verbal horsepower in its behalf is justified. Unless we overcome inertia, there will be no one to blame but ourselves if we wake up someday to discover that the mantle of policymaking is being worn by those specially trained technicians who have found the time to master the machine and have mastered it for their own ends. To paraphrase the words of Jacques Ellul, the French sociologist, that it is to be a dictatorship of dossiers and data banks rather than of hobnailed boots will not make it any the less a dictatorship. Thank you.
About 10 to 15 minutes of questions now, and Professor Miller will be in the coffee lounge from approximately 1:45 to 2:30 to answer any other questions.
Hi, Jeff. Okay, that's a good question. Now, I want to reinforce something I said when I passed over the concept of the ombudsman and the auditor. It's not a cure-all. I mean, who watches the watchers is a classic and very significant problem. All you're really hoping for is you're reducing the odds. Now, how do you control an agency that says, okay, audit my books, my information books, and how do you prevent that agency from having files squirreled away and not shown to the auditor? The only effective way of getting at something like that is, of course, first, to give the auditing agency enormous power to seek out. And second, you can control it through the appropriations process. That you can't gather data without expending money in the collection of the data. Sometimes you pay for it, sometimes you pay people to go out and collect it. And a good auditing agency watching the utilization of appropriated funds to any agency, FBI to HEW, should be able to spot that type of squirreling away. It would be, if it's done on any significant scale, it can be spotted. And by the way, when I talk of an information agency or ombudsman, I am not falling for the gaffe given us by Melvin Ladd a few weeks ago, when he called a press conference and announced that the entire military intelligence establishment was being turned over to civilian control. What Uncle Melvin meant by civilian control was that it was being moved from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the guys with the uniforms on, to the civilian employees of the Defense Department, the guys without the uniforms on. That's not, to me, that's not civilian control. And to me, that's not the kind of ombudsman I'm thinking of. I'm talking about a completely independent group of people whose sole function it is to watch and make sure that there aren't abuses. Yes, sir.